From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ben Brock Johnson, and this is On Point. This could be a pivotal week for Washington and the world. This weekend's meeting in North Korea didn't go so well. We've got a trade war with China. The president promises to name his pick for the next Supreme Court justice tonight. Then he's off to Europe for a NATO summit, and he follows that up with a meeting with Russia's President Putin in Finland. This hour, On Point, the week ahead. You can join us on air or online. What are you hoping for or bracing for with the president's Supreme Court pick? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. All right, so we've got three keen pairs of eyes in Washington watching the headlines and looking ahead. Patricia Zengerli covers Congress and foreign policy for Reuters. Patricia, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Michelle Kaczynski is senior diplomatic correspondent for CNN. Michelle, nice to have you back with us.
Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. And Michael Warren is senior writer at the Weekly Standard. Michael, great to have you too.
Hi, Ben. Thanks.
So, Michael, I want to start with you. Help me set the table here on the Supreme Court pick. It's supposed to be announced tonight at 9 p.m. or thereabouts by the president. We've got a short list of four people. Sources say the president was supposed to have a final pick by the end of last week, but it's down to the wire. Michael, where are we at?
Well, that's where we are, down to the wire. The president likes to make decisions very last minute. We saw him do this, for instance, when it came to the Iran deal and the decisions to certify or not certify those deals were literally made at the very last minute. So I expect this this decision to be no different. We do have four names from that list of 25 potential Supreme Court nominations who have made it the sort of the final round. Amy Coney Barrett is one of them. Thomas Hardiman, sort of coming in at the last minute. Brett Kavanaugh, and the last one is Kethledge. It's anybody's guess about who he's likely to pick. Every single person on that list is has its own group of people who are sort of jockeying for their guy, all saying, our person's up this day, our person's down this day.
Sure.
And so it's really difficult to know. This decision's being made in consultation with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And McConnell is really pushing to have somebody who he believes can get through the Senate really unharmed, somebody with less of a paper trail. And so that alone sort of suggests somebody like Raymond Kethledge or perhaps Thomas Hardiman.
Are those your picks? Do you think those are the folks that we're looking at here? I know we've got four choices and it's anybody's guess. Maybe he'll pick somebody that are not of those four. But is that what you're looking at?
You're not going to pin me down on one
Come
person
on.
Because,
right.
But no, I mean, really, it's so hard to tell. But I do think that Kethledge would really be a consensus pick.
Okay.
He's somebody who I think could get through. Again, you're talking about really two Republican senators, sometimes three, who may be on the fence on this one. And Kethledge seems like somebody who would both please conservatives who are looking for a champion to succeed Anthony Kennedy, but also get through that nomination process. Thomas Hardiman would be somebody who would also get through, but would not, I think, excite conservatives who are concerned about the court possibly drifting toward the middle with this new appointment.
Michelle, what do you think? Is a lack of paper trail and a lack of record here the thing that's going to get the nominee through?
It's possible. And I think, you know, when you look at how this is being set up now by the president, the suspense, the cliffhanger, so it allows for this debate about each person's past and credentials. And that's what kind of muddies it up as to, well, who does the president really like here? But he has spoken out about Kethledge, Hardiman. I think in discussions, those are the two possible picks that people tend to lean towards for the reasons that we've talked about. But I think what really is confusing is how much the potential, or maybe some would say imminent, overturning of Roe v. Wade is in this, and how much that's going to affect senators who are going to have this vote. How pressured are they going to be by that very real possibility? Although you could say that that's going to be a question anyway. So I'm looking at the red state senators, the Democrats out there,
Sure.
And how they could potentially react to this. But it's another one of those things where the president puts it out there, builds up the suspense, but we really don't know until we know at sure. 9 p.m. tonight. Or sure. Maybe I should say, stay tuned.
Yeah, and I want to talk about those red state Democrats and Roe v. Wade, of course. But speaking of building up that suspense, let's hear President Trump as he boarded his helicopter to head back to Washington from New Jersey on Sunday. He told reporters there isn't a bad choice in his short list of Supreme Court nominees.
I'm getting very close to making a final decision.
Not yet.
And I believe this person will do a great job. But I'm very close to making a decision. Have not made it official yet, obviously. Have not made it final, but we're very close to making a decision.
All right, Patricia, we haven't heard from you yet. What are you thinking about the president really keeping it down to the wire here? And who are you looking at as a potential front runner?
Well, I'm going to join the others. I'm not going to give a front runner. But one thing that I'm reminded of is when the president announced Neil Gorsuch, he seemed very pleased that it hadn't been leaked and no one knew. Remember, he gave it and he said, wasn't that a surprise?
Hmm.
So who knows? Maybe it won't even be one of those four names, and maybe it will be someone else.
Patricia, looking forward as to sort of what happens in Congress once the nominee is announced, are you, like Michelle, kind of watching these red state Democrats? You know, there's question here about how they're going to fare in the midterms, depending on the nominee and how they vote.
Yes, I think everybody is. And there's the three in particular who voted for Gorsuch. Donnelly from Indiana, Heitkamp from North Dakota, and Manchin from West Virginia, states that went huge for Trump, and they're in very tight reelection races. And there's also a lot of attention given to, obviously, Senators Murkowski and Collins, the two moderate Republicans.
Sure.
But they both voted for Gorsuch, and if you look at their records, they voted with Trump an overwhelming majority of the time, including on a lot of the federal judges that he's been appointing.
Yeah, I heard someone yesterday.
Strongly anti-abortion.
Yeah, I heard someone yesterday speaking on one of the morning shows, basically suggesting that they were just going to the red state Democrats were going to wait to see how the Republicans voted, and you know, wait for those moderate Republicans to sort of come out and say who they were going to support or how or whether they were going to support, and then kind of follow that lead. Michael, what about you? Do you think that these red state Democrats could face trouble in the midterms, depending on how this all goes?
I think they're facing pressure from both sides here. They're facing pressure, as we've talked about, from the right. They're running in these states that Trump won. They're up for re-election. This is going to be an issue, even outside of those three Democrats who voted for Gorsuch. It's an issue in red states with Democrats running for re-election. Claire McCaskill is a Democrat from Missouri. Her Republican opponent, Josh Hawley, up with an ad that's making an issue of the Supreme Court before we even have a nominee. So I think this is going to be a big push from the right, but also from the left. Look, this is an issue that the left is mobilized on and is very, very passionate about because of the fear, which I think is maybe not as founded as others do, that this nominee will help overturn Roe v. Wade. I actually think the decision, if they do make one, will be a little narrower, as we've seen John Roberts move a little more toward the center and a little more toward keeping precedent at the forefront of his decision making. So, but I do think that there is going to be that pressure, whether it's from donors, from interest and activist groups, for even those Democrats in red states to toe the party line. And that's why they'll be smart, I think, to wait to see what happens with Collins and Murkowski. If this nominee can get through on a party line vote, then maybe the pressure is off for them because they won't be the deciding vote, those Democrats, on whether or not this person gets appointed to the court.
And it's also interesting, since this is such a Republican issue, but you're seeing Democrats the ones talking up the potential for Roe v. Wade, and many Republicans trying to tone that down and back away from it because they want what they want. They want their nominee to get through.
Yeah, it's a battle of narrative about that precedent. So let's just go really quickly to some more audio here regarding this kind of calculus, at least on the Democrat side. Here was Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, looking ahead to the confirmation battle for the next Supreme Court justice.
Each senator understands this is an historic decision. It'll decide the future of this court for a generation or more. And so I know they'll look carefully at each nominee. I can't predict how all of my 49 or 48 colleagues in the Senate on the Democratic side will vote. I will tell you, though, simple math tells you if John McCain is absent, it's a 50-49 Senate. One Republican senator can decide the fate of any Supreme Court nominee.
All right. Patricia, can you react to that? What do you think about Senator Durbin's comments there?
I think he's right, and he knows his caucus, that if a Republican changes, as we've been saying, it's going to take the heat off these Democrats either way. One other point I wanted to make on the Supreme Court is another issue that is also big. People tend to focus on the abortion issue, but health care is going to be huge. Mm. And the fate of Obamacare is eventually going to come down to the Supreme Court. And there has been some talk about among Democrats that they should be talking more about that than rather than getting distracted with the Roe decision.
All right. Well, guests, stick with us, please. We're looking at the week ahead in Washington and the world. You can join the conversation. We're going to take some calls. What do you make of the strange headlines out of Secretary of State Pompeo's meeting with North Korean officials? What do you hope for or fear will come out of the president's meeting with NATO leaders? I'm Ben Johnson. This is On Point.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Ben Brock Johnson. We are taking stock of a busy week ahead in the news. Two big meetings for the president in Europe, the unfolding trade war with China, and more. You can join the conversation. Have you felt the bite of our trade war with China? How do you think the President Trump's meeting will go with NATO? How do you feel about President Trump's off-the-record meeting upcoming with Vladimir Putin? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests this hour are Michael Warden, senior writer at the Weekly Standard, Patricia Zengerli, who covers Congress and foreign policy for Reuters, and Michelle Kaczynski, senior diplomatic correspondent for CNN. And before we move on to our next topic, I want to take a call on this Supreme Court decision. Nate is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, how are you? Welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I was going to say there's definitely some tensions within the Republicans, I think, over the Roe decision, because I know one of your guests mentioned precedent, but precedent already went out the window with the Janus decision, so that's not a motivating factor for some judges. And now you've got Trump trying to assure the general public that he's not going to ask people about Roe. You had, to the contrary, just like a weekend ago, where the co-founder of Women for Trump said that Roe was going to stand and they weren't going to overturn it. But pro-lifers have been supporting Republicans under the idea that Roe was going to be overturned, and they've been doing it for years. So this would be a real big betrayal, and somebody is not being honest with somebody, and we just don't know who yet.
Fair.
You had with Neil Gorsuch, hey, he supported rigged elections in one of his latest decisions. So there's still going to be a whole bunch of decisions to annoy Democrats with.
Okay, Nate, thank you very much for your call. You bring up some interesting points here. I think Nate was talking about, Michael, your suggestions around precedent. But Michelle, I want to ask you about this. What do you think about Nate's point? Just that there are, of course, battling narratives here, and someone on one side or the other is not being straightforward about what happens next in the Supreme Court versus in regards to Roe versus Wade.
Well, right. I mean, I think that's always the trouble around this issue, that it's always going to be this big talking point. I mean, remember during the campaign, all of the pressure that was put on that this is going to happen once I start appointing justices. It was the vice president who said that it was going to be relegated to, Roe v. Wade would be relegated to the ash heap of history if this happened. So it's always going to be a rallying point for both sides. The reality is, and what we've seen over the decades, is that you just don't know what's going to happen until cases start to be brought. And some of this can be handled, as we've seen over the last couple of years, at the state level. So it's going to be a pressure point no matter how you look at it.
Ben, can I mention this here?
Sure,
as well?
Quickly. Go ahead.
The issue, I think, is exactly what Michelle says, that we don't know. And in fact, politicians, presidents, don't always know what the judges that they appoint and the justices they appoint are going to do. In fact, there's quite a bit of diversity, if you will, among the way conservative jurists think about these issues. Everybody assumes that, for instance, Clarence Thomas and Justice Alito, because they reach the same conclusion often, that they have the same path to getting there. And that's not necessarily true. And so it can be very difficult to suss out exactly where these justices are going. And I think that we've learned that from Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, over the last decade or so, that people thought he was going to be much more of a strict originalist than he has turned out to be, in
Fair
many
enough.
Ways because his position requires him to sort of guide the court as an institution. And it's for that reason that I think that it's less likely that he will guide the court, guide the majority to a complete overturning of Roe v. Wade because of the political implications of that.
Okay, well, I guess we'll find out all of this eventually. Much more to talk about on this topic, as the announcement presumably comes this evening, and of course tomorrow we'll be talking about this on the show. I want to shift gears now and actually backpedal just a little bit and talk about the North Korea meeting over the weekend. I want to play some tape here now from over the weekend. Pretty strange headlines coming out of this meeting with what appears to be very different, again, narratives of what happened at the meeting. On Saturday, North Korea said the Trump administration is pushing a, quote, unilateral and gangster-like demand for denuclearization. Here was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's response.
I am counting on Chairman Kim to be determined to follow through on the commitment that he made. And so if those requests were gangster-like, they are, the world is a gangster, because there was a unanimous decision at the UN Security Council about what needs to be achieved.
Yeah, and just to sort of dig into this a little bit more, here's some more sound. There were some tense exchanges between Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and the North Korean official leading the talks, Kim Yong-chol, and sometimes downright really strange. Did you sleep well last night? Kim asked. Pompeo said yes. Kim then repeated the question more ominously. Let's take a listen.
Very serious discussion on very important matters yesterday. So thinking about those discussions, you might have not slept well last night.
Director Kim, I slept just fine.
Yeah, just some weird chatter there and weird headlines coming out of that meeting. Michelle, let me start with you. What's your read on what happened? I know Pompeo said that basically all of the major agenda items of the U.S. had moved forward over the weekend. Is that your impression?
Well, if it wasn't North Korea, I mean, you need the weird headlines, right? We are dealing with North Korea here. I think we'd all be a bit disappointed if something strange didn't happen. But this was... I don't want to say it was unexpected. I think it was unexpected in the way it played out. All of a sudden, you hear this rhetoric now from North Korea using words like gangster and cancerous demands. It seems like we've taken a few steps back, but you really did start to see the writing in the wall during that exchange that you played after the first round of meetings. These two men, Secretary of State Pompeo and Kim Jong-un's right-hand man, Kim Yong-chol, they've met before. So they're coming back again, which makes this even stranger. They have 2 days of talks. After the first day, you hear Secretary of State Pompeo not unsurprisingly talk about progress that was made. But you could really hear the tension there. So that was the first indication all was not well. So in the end, it wasn't that surprising that you see this rift form. And you know why else it wasn't surprising? Because we just have these vague commitments, or let's just call it one commitment, basically.
Right.
This has been vague from the beginning. And I feel like this is becoming, we don't know how it's going to turn out.
Sure.
But it's becoming a lesson in why you do this groundwork before you have a big summit between two leaders, because then you get rid of the uncertainty. And I think what this tells us is that huge yawning chasm between what the U.S. calls denuclearization ultimately and what North Korea thinks of as denuclearization. It's still there. Maybe it's even bigger now.
Right.
It's nothing has changed. And that is disturbing. I'm not faulting the two leaders for meeting. I think, especially when you're dealing with these two, maybe anything could happen and progress really could be made. But we're starting to see why so many analysts were saying, wait a minute, you are dealing with North Korea. This could take a long time. We've been burned before. They've said this before. And look at the kinds of language that North Korea is using when they talk about denuclearization. It's the same stuff they've been saying for decades. It's as if nothing has really changed in their view either.
Patricia, let me get you to react to that as well. Is this a lesson in, doing the groundwork and building the scaffolding before you put top leadership in the room together? Or is it just some sort of kabuki as these two sides figure out how to interact with each other at a high level?
I think that North Korea is still trying to sound out Pompeo and the Trump administration to see how they'll respond to some of this stuff.
Okay.
I think, let's call them gangsters or say they're acting like gangsters and see how they respond. But one other thing about these talks that's kind of strange, well, so much is strange, is that the Secretary of State has been, to this point, kind of the lead negotiator. Normally, and I know normal is a different word when dealing with North Korea, but you would have a lower level group of people doing the talks. And then the Secretary of State would come in near the end, hopefully with something positive to say, okay, we're going to seal the deal. And there would be handshakes.
And photos.
Now, and photos.
Yeah, of course.
This is a thing. And I was talking, some of the experts I've talked to have also made the point that it's a good thing now that they've finally set up, not finally, but they've set up a working group who's going to handle the negotiations going forward, which takes Pompeo out of it. Because if Pompeo looks weak on this, it could weaken him in dealing with a whole range of other issues.
Okay.
Very
interesting retrofitting that working group onto the process and the idea that perhaps this could sort of hurt the Secretary of State going forward. I want to go to a caller. This is Kay calling from Waterloo in Iowa. Kay, welcome to the show. What's your thought?
It's actually just a comment, and it is that Trump got played. He got played by the North Koreans.
Why do you think that is? How did that happen?
He got nothing out of this, nothing that he can hold up as anything permanent and satisfactory. And sending Pompeo back to try to tidy up and get some kind of agreement is a sign of weakness on our part. And nothing was achieved except probably a large photo op. A victory run around the course for anybody who cared to believe. But I think it's a case of the emperor's clothes.
Fair enough. Kay, thank you very much for your call and for your thoughts. I want to shift gears again now and go from one foreign policy debate over the weekend to some stuff that is coming up. Let's talk about NATO. you know, there's been this kind of tension going into this meeting that the president has coming up this week. He's been pressuring allies, sending letters about this 2% GDP spending on military support ahead of this NATO meeting. And you've got NATO members, NATO allies pushing back. Spain, for instance, saying, yeah, we only spend 1% of our GDP on NATO military support, but it's very active spending. Michael, sort of, can you help again to sort of set the stage here? It looks like this is a pretty tense meeting coming up for the president.
Once again, meeting with allies, particularly allies in Europe, with Trump means tension. And this is something that's been long on the president's radar screen, that NATO, that we pay too much for NATO, that the other countries need to pay their fair share as if it's sort of a dues program. Mm. I think it's going to be very when you juxtapose that tension that we expect the president to bring to this meeting with what very well may be a conciliatory meeting following in Helsinki with Vladimir Putin, the
right.
President of Russia. I think that on top of what we saw last month at the G7 summit in Quebec, where the president really left that summit on his way to Singapore. We were just talking about North Korea.
Sure.
On his way to that Singapore summit, really trashing the allies, not just the Europeans, but also the Canadians.
Yes.
And Justin Trudeau. I think that is sending signals. It's been sending signals for the last several months. That the president and the United States are not as reliable of allies to the G7 and to our European allies and to other allies in our region as maybe they thought, and I think that is sort of the what's underscoring this upcoming meeting. And you juxtapose it again with whether it's the Singapore summit or this Helsinki summit with Putin, and there's this confusion, I think, when it comes to not just foreign policy but trade as well, where people are wondering, can we count on the United States any longer? I think that's something that is certainly troubling.
Michelle, quickly, let me get you to react to this idea that allies are not happy about the potential of Trump having another acrimonious meeting with them and then skipping off to Finland and making nice with Putin. Do you think that's a real issue for NATO going forward? And do you think some things might fall apart, for lack of a better term, at this meeting coming up just because of the juxtaposition of these two meetings?
Well, it could. I think that when you look at what happened after the G7, with this harsh criticism that came out of it, almost in the same breath of the president saying that Russia should be readmitted to make it the G8 again, that was surprising. That just added to the rankling of U.S. allies. And there's been this building up with last week, these letters. Well, they weren't sent last week, but last week the letters emerged
sure.
of the White House pressuring U.S. allies and using very unfriendly language, I guess I would call it, to try to get them to pay up. When the issue is everybody agrees that more should be paid, it just takes some time. And the goal wasn't immediately. The goal was to boost the spending that each country does on its own defense over a period of about 10 years. So they see this as overblown anyway. Hmm. And I know from talking to senior diplomats of U.S. allies, there was worry around NATO when we knew that the White House was working on a potential meeting with Vladimir Putin. If it came before NATO, as was a possibility, they thought that was very bad, although some could see it as, well, first he'd meet with Putin and then brief U.S. allies. So it all depends on how you view it.
Fair.
There are U.S. allies, and in fact, the Secretary General of NATO has said it's fine. Leaders at this level of these countries, these powers in the world, should be meeting with each other. It's just that the Trump administration has so much baggage already as relates to Russia that no matter how you place it, it's always going to be looked at askance unless the president himself starts verbally getting tough on Russia. So as one diplomat told me, if it's all smiles at NATO, or it's, if it's all smiles with Putin and all snarls at NATO, that just sends a very bad message.
All right, we'll leave it there for a moment. We're looking ahead to a busy week in the news. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for more brawls over the Mueller investigation in this week's congressional hearings? I'm Ben Johnson. Guests will stick with us. This is On Point.
This is Peter Sagal. When we began Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we dreamed that our rude jokes would be, in the end, the appropriate way to talk about the news. And look, it happened. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ben Brock Johnson. We are looking ahead at what we can expect in this week's headlines. There are some tough hearings expected in Congress this week when Republicans grill FBI agent Peter Stock. Will you be watching? Has the rescue of the boys' soccer team in Thailand got you transfixed? Is it a welcome glimmer of international cooperation we can all celebrate? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests this hour are Patricia Zengerli, who covers Congress and foreign policy for Reuters, Michelle Kaczynski, senior diplomatic correspondent for CNN, and Michael Warren, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. We've been flying through this stuff, and there's a lot to talk about, but I want to start off this hour listening to Senator Roy Blunt, Republican of Missouri, who was on Meet the Press yesterday morning. Host Chuck Todd pressed him on whether the president had been naive in his dealings with North Korea. So we're just going to hear some of this sound here, and whether he worried about Trump's meeting later this week with Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Here was Senator Blunt.
I think it's fine to talk to the Russians, but the president should clearly understand that neither the Russians nor dictators like Kim Jong-un are going to be charmed by anybody. They are very cold-blooded, calculating. Well, Putin would be in that category.
I was just going to...
So just really quickly, Michael, I want to get a quick reaction from you on that. This meeting, this off-the-record meeting between President Trump and Putin, it seems to be, you know, it seems to have resulted in a lot of hand-wringing. Do you think it's a potential huge problem for the president? I mean, people have talked about, you know, giving Putin Crimea, and what other things might sort of come out of that meeting as a surprise or as a disappointment to some people, even in Trump's own administration. So I don't know, just a quick reaction, I guess, to this meeting and how it's all kind of lining up.
Sure. It echoes what a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill and even within the administration were concerned about before the Singapore summit with Kim Jong-un. They are very concerned that sort of Trump, without preparation, without really a script to follow, and this is a very unscripted president, may agree to something that goes against what American values, American foreign policy is. You mentioned Crimea. This is something that the president himself has said could be on the table. Look, you can look at a tweet that the president sent out Monday about North Korea to see exactly why somebody like Senator Blunt would be concerned. Regarding North Korea, Donald Trump said, "I have confidence that Kim Jong-un will honor the contract we signed and, even more importantly, our handshake." This is not exactly what happened in Singapore. There was no contract. And the handshake, of course, is worth essentially nothing with Kim Jong-un. And I think a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill are concerned that the president is going to make the same mistakes that his predecessors have with regard to Vladimir Putin. We remember George W. Bush said he looked into Putin's eyes and saw his soul. There's some real fear and justified fear. The president will, President Trump will have a handshake with Vladimir Putin and feel satisfied.
Fair enough. Okay, so I know that there's much more to talk about there, including the president's love of handshakes, I suppose. But the next on our list here that we should talk about is trade wars. Obviously, the trade war is officially kicked off, basically last week, end of last week. I don't know. There's been some debate as to whether or not, people are already feeling this, I suppose, around the country, or at least in a way that could have a permanent or semi-permanent impact on the larger economy. But I want to start with some tape of Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who was on Fox News Sunday talking about China and trade and saying the U.S. is in a fight with China, one that it can win.
We got more bullets than they do when it comes to trade. We sell them $100 billion. They sell us $500 billion. We can hurt them more than they'll hurt us. And all we're looking for is for them to stop cheating when it comes to trade.
So it's pretty bellicose language there, Patricia. What do you think about the senator's comments and whether or not the U.S. can hurt China more?
Yeah, it's complicated.
Fair.
There is kind of an assumption in a lot of the discussion of this issue that every country that sells you more goods than you sell them is not necessarily cheating. I'm not saying China isn't, quote unquote, cheating, but the U.S., it's U.S. companies that decide to make a lot of products in China. You know, it's not that. The language is tough, but in reality, I mean, getting back to Congress and legislation.
Sure.
There's a bill that a few senators led by Senator Bob Corker, a Republican, want to get passed that would take away the president's right to impose tariffs on national security grounds without getting it cleared by Congress first. And they can't even get a vote on that bill.
Fair. All right. So I want to, we just heard from Senator Lindsey Graham, as well as Patricia, of course, and I want to play some more sound here. This is Ron Heck, a soybean farmer from Iowa, who told Fox Business on Friday that the Trump administration's new tariffs made it impossible for American soybean farmers to turn a profit.
These tariffs are ill-conceived and totally inappropriate, using food as a weapon, raising the price of food to the Chinese people, and devastating United States farmers as a lose-lose situation for everyone.
So, Michelle, let me get you to react to this. Is it a lose-lose situation? Will the U.S. be able to stare down China? I was looking at the extremely long list of potential, products that could be impacted by this week. And it's a really long list. I saw a preliminary list that was like batteries and thumb drives things that I was like, oh, that's no big deal. But when I looked at a longer list, it looked a lot more serious, of course. So
it's also components that American companies, an American company making things here is
sure.
going to import a lot of the components for that from China. So now they're stuck. So you this is always the problem with trade wars and with tariffs, because it just depends on who you are, how you're affected. It depends on your company, what kind of thing you produce, what your supply chain is. So there are going to be winners and there are going to be losers. We don't know yet how this is going to affect the company. I mean, there are lots of extreme historical examples. For example, the trade wars contributed to the Great Recession because they were so harsh. I don't know that anybody looking at this sees this as necessarily being a long, long, long-term thing.
Sure.
It's almost negotiating and pressure and bullying. I mean, there's been accusations of that on both sides. For everybody to finally come together and say, okay, let's finally level the playing field. I think many people see this as a really irresponsible way of going about it.
Mm.
So, and you know, I'll say this one thing. Not that long ago, I talked to a CEO who was a former CEO of a major U.S. multinational company. And his view, I thought, was well put, that he thought, okay, there does need to be a leveling of the playing field, that he was all for that.
Okay.
He said, why don't we just go to China and say, you need to buy X more amounts of U.S. products. We need to level this out. And that by doing it the trade war way is just very defensive, and it's also hurting many U.S. companies.
Immediately gets pretty complicated, as you're saying there, Michelle. And I want to go now to a caller. Keith is calling from Iowa Falls, Iowa, and he's got a perspective on this. Keith, what are your thoughts?
Hi, Ben. Yeah, I'm a farmer here in Iowa, and we've endured several years of declining commodity prices, and the fundamentals are pretty weak for most commodity prices right now anyway.
Hmm.
So this trade war, these tariffs, could not have come at a worse time for Iowa farmers or for farmers across the U.S. Beyond that, the economy of Iowa itself, whether we like it or not, is closely linked to the price of corn and other commodities.
Sure.
So I just want to say that it's devastating. It is absolutely devastating what's happened to the price of soybeans and, to a lesser extent, corn and some other commodities.
Keith, stay with us here. I want to ask you a couple of follow-ups, and I'm sorry if I missed it, but what exactly, what do you farm? And paint the picture a little bit more for me. You're describing this as devastating. What does that mean in your family and in your business?
Well, what it means is that you can farm all year and lose money. And when it costs you $9 to raise a bushel of soybeans and the price of soybeans is $8, you don't make it up on volume. And the point is, the entire economy of the state is going to be hurt. You know, while there may be only 90,000 farmers in Iowa, there's a huge industry in supplying farmers. And they aren't buying. Farmers aren't buying much of anything right now unless they absolutely have to.
Mm. Keith, thank you very much for your call and for giving us a view of the ground there in Iowa Falls. Folks, I want to move again to another topic. It just seems like an endless list for us here of all the things going on this week, and it really is pretty amazing. But obviously, the Mueller investigation is something that we need to talk about quickly. So, this FBI agent who's going to be on Capitol Hill, there's some intensity around this hearing potentially. Michael, what do you think we're going to see in the hearing?
Well, Peter Strzok, that FBI agent who was discovered to be sending these text messages with a woman in another FBI employee with whom he was having an affair,
sure,
that were seen as anti-Trump. He's basically become a punching bag for Republicans in the House, particularly on the Judiciary and Oversight Committees, as an example of the inherent bias in the investigation that has now become the Mueller special counsel investigation. So I think they're going to be really, really tough. And I think you're going to see Democrats probably mistakenly try to defend Strzok instead of pointing out that while his actions, his talk of hating Trump and all these,
sure,
things in the run-up to the election really don't have any bearing on the Mueller investigation itself, and the fact that the Mueller investigation has already come away with more than a dozen indictments and continues to be investigating whether or not there was any connection between Trump associates and the Russians in the Russian meddling in the 2016 election. So I think this will be a bit of a sideshow. It's something that Congress is very,
sure,
good at doing.
But
I don't doubt that it will have an effect on, as we've already seen, the Mueller investigation, and particularly Robert Mueller himself. We've seen his political stock, his rating in political polls has dropped, and I think in large part because of the feeling, of the sense that the investigation itself is biased from the outset. And Peter Strzok is a big reason why people feel that way, even though Robert Mueller removed Strzok from his investigation,
sure,
after finding out about these text messages.
Okay, so I want to get quick reactions, if possible, from Patricia and then Michelle. Patricia, what do you think of Michael's comments here? Are the Republicans going to successfully connect this particular FBI agent's story to the larger questioning of the Mueller investigation?
Well, they're certainly going to try. and it's also an interesting point is this hearing on Thursday with Strzok is two committees. It's not just judiciary. It's also they're adding the Oversight Committee. which has a much bigger staff to do investigations. So it doubles the amount of people you can get working on this. They're also trying to do it, of course, before the midterm elections, because if they lose control of the House, there won't be the subpoena power. But one thing that will make this hearing a little bit interesting is that Jim Jordan.
Oh, yes.
Yes. I covered the last hearing with the FBI and DOJ officials. Uh-huh. And he was one of the most aggressive questioners of them.
And been caught up in this.
He's now been caught up in the Ressler, Ohio State thing himself.
Right. These sexual abuse allegations. And so maybe you think he'll be a little bit quieter these hearings coming up?
I've learned not to predict, but I think he'll certainly be someone who will be very interesting to see.
Fair.
how it happens and how the issue comes up. And then another related point is that, well, this is going on in the House and undermining what critics say is undermining the Mueller investigation or leading to questions, certainly contributing to polling, the point that was made, is the Senate Intelligence Committee is quietly proceeding with its investigation. Uh-huh. And just the other day put out a report confirming the findings of the intelligence community that Russia interfered with the election, which completely contradicts the findings of the House Intelligence Committee, which criticized sources, the methods used by the intelligence agencies.
Interesting. Michelle, I'm sure you have thoughts on this, but just really quickly before we go, I'd like to touch on the last story that we wanted to touch on today, which is, at least I feel, a relatively, at this point in the game, a pretty uplifting story, the story of the soccer team stuck in that cave system in Thailand.
Happy news?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
must have missed that.
I mean, there. I know
just
it's
kidding.
It seems hard to imagine, but I don't know. Do you have any reaction to this? It sounds like 7 or 8 of the boys are out at this point. And that's
right.
Great.
Yeah. So there's still some in there. So, you know, it's still touch and go. Remember, one of the elite Thai divers that was trying to get them out died during this. I mean, that shows you how he was an experienced diver. But this has been one of those stories that has all the elements of drama and surprise, something for the world really to rally around and hope that these children get out of there. To see some of that happen over the weekend was incredible.
Fair.
I mean, what a great story.
Fair. Yeah. And I think we'll have to leave it there. Next time we'll do 6 hours together, folks.
Let's do it.
Thanks to Patricia Zengerle, Michelle Kaczynski, and Michael Warren for being with us on this hour talking about this news. I'm Ben Brock Johnson. This is On Point.